Good afternoon. Welcome along. I'm Justin Briley, your host for Unbelievable this afternoon. And it is, of course, the last Unbelievable of 2014. I hope you've had a good year. It's certainly been an exciting year for Unbelievable in terms of live events and shows and the resources we managed to produce in 2014. And we're hoping for an equally brilliant 2015. And I'll be telling you some of the things to look forward to. Important news as well about what we're doing in terms of Unbelievable, the conference in the coming year. So do stay tuned to the end of today's programme if you're interested in hearing about that. We've got a great discussion coming up for you on the programme today, though, as ever. Christians and non-Christians join me to discuss faith and belief. And today we're specifically asking the question, how do we explain our faith? Later on today on Premier Christian Radio, as part of Faith Explored, you can hear the profile interview. And Graham Lotz is going to be in studio talking to Charmaine Noble McLean about her life and faith and, of course, her well-known father, Billy Graham. So look forward to that between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. Right now, though, let's get into the subject of today's programme. You're unbelievable. Today we're discussing how to explain your faith to others. It's a conversation between three people joining me today. In studio, I'm joined by the Right Reverend John Pritchard. He's the former Bishop of Oxford and the author of How to Explain Your Faith, published by SBCK. It's a very practical book for Christians who want to explain their faith to others and maybe even to themselves. Our other guest, Andrew Nightingale, is an atheist, but he's an unusual one because he regularly attends a Baptist church with his wife in the north of England where he lives. Well, he's joining us on the line to give us a perspective on what he finds interesting, confusing and even unbelievable about church and the Christian faith. And a third guest joining us on today's discussion as well, Mark Rock. He's director of Reality Bites, which is the national training ministry of the West Yorkshire School of Christian Studies. He's a storyteller. He's a philosopher. He spent many years pioneering fresh ways of communicating Christian faith to a secular audience. And he's been a guest on the show in previous years, but hasn't been on for quite a while. So it's going to be great to have him back with us to talk about how he believes Christians can effectively share their faith, communicate it and explain it. But before we meet Andrew and Mark, let's have a chat with our studio guest, the Right Reverend John Pritchard. Great to meet you, John.
And you, Justin.
It's great to have you in. I've been a big fan of your books. I think they're very practical, very useful, and you've produced many over the years. The one we're looking at today, How to Explain Your Faith, I think it's actually a sort of a republishing of one that came out 2006, was it?
It seems to have sold reasonably well, Justin. So SBCK decided to have another launch of it, and I hope the arguments in it are pretty timeless. Well, I trust so anyway.
Yes. I mean, I suppose when you first wrote this, it might have been just at about the time that the new atheism was picking up speed and so on. I mean, I guess several years on, do you think that these are more important than ever for Christians to be able to do this sort of thing?
I do, really. I think we've kind of lost our nerve in some senses as in terms of this apologetic, you know, if we can use that word, but the kind of explaining and defending the Christian faith. And I don't think, you know, I do think, actually, a lot of Christians are a little bit anxious about the big questions, you know, okay, why do you believe in God, you know, and what about suffering then? And what about all these other faiths? And why is church so naff? And, you know, all these questions. And I think we just need answers. And so I was trying to make some suggestions, starting points, not telling other people how to argue, but just saying, here are some points you might like to consider. And there they are in this book.
How did you find your faith initially?
Well, good Christian upbringing didn't mean very much. You know, lovely to have, and I respect it hugely now. But at the time, you know, I went to church because that's where the girls were and that's where the fun was. And,
is that still the case?
I couldn't possibly say. I've been married rather a long time. You know, it was when I went to university and met people and listened to arguments and found that actually I'd got lots of the bits of the Christian faith all lying around, you know, like a jigsaw puzzle with all the pieces around, bit of church, bit of prayer, bit of Bible, bit of, you know, all the stuff. But the central piece was missing, and that central piece was this person of Jesus Christ, and I hadn't really taken that seriously enough. So put Christ in the centre and it all begins to make some kind of sense. Well, enough sense to support me for 42 years of being ordained. So it was going to university and having to rethink everything, as you do when you go away and you know, everything's thrown up in the air. So lots of experimentation, and faith was one of them.
You've only very recently retired, and of course you were overseeing the Diocese of Oxford, and before that, Jarrow. Does the life of a bishop enable you to have these kinds of conversations, or is it all bureaucracy and red tape?
There's too much of the admin. But actually, I mean, I had, 815 churches in the Diocese of Oxford? So there's an awful lot of relating to people. But in, to answer your question, wonderful opportunities to talk about things that mattered in schools or in debates or in writing, in broadcasting, all kinds of ways. And so, yeah, I loved that kind of exchange of views, of ideas, of understandings, without wanting in any sense to be arrogant, but wanting just to say, this is the best thing I've found. What kind of sense does this make to you?
Yeah. I watched a video of yours the other day in which you described how you tried to, as a young Christian, convince, I think it was an aunt or a grandmother or someone, sort of with the intellectual arguments for Christianity, thought you'd done a great job. And she said, at the end of the day, I just still can't believe it. What explaining your faith, I'm guessing, is more than just explaining how everything logically fits together, right?
Absolutely. And it was one of those critical moments for me, just when this very intelligent grandmother said to me, you may have won the argument. In fact, you have won the argument, but you haven't convinced me. And that difference is really rather important. And I think it's to do actually with the integrity of how people live and whether people see anything different as well, whether it makes an emotional connection and a connection at other levels, not just the brain. The brain's really important. The intellect is absolutely crucial. But it needs to be a much more holistic response that we make to this Christian faith that seems to be the best story, the story that makes most sense of most things most of the time, which is what I find that Christian faith does.
Well, I think we're going to have a really interesting discussion, just a very much an open-ended conversation today on the programme. And if you're interested in getting in touch yourself and you'd like to get hold of a copy of the book, maybe, I'm going to put links to the show on the show page to the book How to Explain Your Faith by my studio guest John Pritchard today. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable for today's show, for links to my guests as well, and for ways to get in touch. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also get in touch via the social media at UnbelievableJB, the Twitter account, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you want to follow on Facebook. I'll give you a reminder of those a little later on in the programme. Well, let's go to the phones now. And one of the people we've got on the line joining us today is Andrew Nightingale. Andrew, thanks for being with us today on the show.
No problem.
It's great to have you on. You're a fascinating man, Andrew, because you're an atheist. But as I say, you're an unusual one. You're a churchgoer. Would you mind explaining to us what makes you go along to church on a fairly regular basis, I think, along with your wife, when you yourself don't profess to have any faith?
I think it touches on what John's just mentioned about the best testament is the way people live their lives. And the people in the church I go to, I'm impressed by how they live their lives and how friendly they are and how open they are. And it's really, it's like I say, they're my family, and it's that friendship that holds it all together. Christians get a pretty bad press, and it's easy to stereotype them. And going to church stops me from putting Christians in a pigeonhole, which is unhelpful.
Well, I'm incredibly impressed by your openness at that level to kind of devote yourself to, obviously, a church community. What do they make of you, Andrew? I'd just be interested. Are you sort of treated as a project every Sunday? You know, let's see if we can convert Andrew this week. Or how does it work?
I'm not casting my mind back. I don't think I've ever felt like a project. And that's another, I'll give them credit for that as well. I think that I've been appreciated because I've started discussions within the church. There are discussions that people have been afraid to have, and having me come along and not know about these red lines you're not supposed to cross has allowed other people to start talking about things.
That's interesting. Right. Putting the cat among the pigeons a little. I mean, I'd just be interested to know what made you start attending in the first place. Did you have any faith yourself growing up? Did you lose your faith? What was the process?
My mum made me go to church because she wanted me to get into a Christian church school in Wigan. And so I was part of the choir. And so I kind of know the first order, one of the orders kind of, yeah, it didn't really mean anything to me at the time. And I've never really had a faith. The reason I started going to church was actually to try and advertise myself in the church newsletter.
Yeah, I see. A commercial interest.
Yeah. and I thought, it's no point just phoning around. I have to actually go there, see the person who has the magazine, see if they have any adverts. So, I thought I'd just nip in at the end, grab a magazine and head out. But they always start late at Crag, so what I thought was late was actually bang on time. And there's a lovely lady called Mavis who... I couldn't say no, so she dragged me into the service, and then the rest is history.
And you've been going a few years now?
Yeah, about 6 years.
Okay, there you go. All right, lovely to talk to you, Andrew, and be interested to get your input on this, sort of as an insider-outsider, I suppose, and your perspective on Christian faith, and obviously the many conversations you've had with people, and obviously you're a regular listener of the show as well, so you're aware of the kind of debates we have on the programme. Mark Rock is also with us on the line. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, good to be here. But by the way, I just should say that I also go to the same church as Andrew.
This is a funny little coincidence, but this was why, in fact, when I was setting up the show with Andrew and encouraging him to come on to talk to John, he said, oh, could Mark come on? And we realised we had a mutual acquaintance in common through you, Mark. So you're obviously based up in the north as well. And is this a recent thing that you've got to know Andrew?
Yeah, it's only been over the past few weeks. Where I've been involved in doing a course at the West Yorkshire School of Christian Studies, run by a colleague of mine called Transforming Vision, and Andrew's been coming along to that. And I kind of seem to bump into him a lot. And we also go to the same Baptist church now.
There you go.
And I would just thoroughly agree with him that it is a very, very friendly church, and that's definitely been something, an aspect of why my wife and I, we really enjoy going there.
There you go. Mark, you're director of Reality Bites. It's as I said, the National Training Ministry of the West Yorkshire School of Christian Studies. But, I mean, what I like about Reality Bites, and when you've come on in the past on Unbelievable, is you're a storyteller, and you communicate what you do by stories. What's the value for you of storytelling as opposed to just, you know, rational discourse?
Well, to link in with this conversation about sharing faith, I've been talking to a cleaner at the local gym where I go and try and keep fit, and I've just told her a few of my stories, and she just keeps saying to me, "Oh, I find these stories so fascinating. I love it when you tell me stories." And so I found that a great way of connecting with people is telling people quite intriguing, but also sometimes dramatic stories, and then to talk about issues from the stories. And I personally have found that a much more effective way of doing mission than the way I used to do it, say, about 10 years ago.
Well, we'll hear some stories later, I imagine. But
I hope so, yeah.
It's great to have you on the show again, Mark. My guest today, then, Right Reverend John Pritchard, Andrew Nightingale, and Mark Rock. We're going to be talking about explaining your faith today, and that's the title of John Pritchard's book, How to Explain Your Faith, published by SBCK. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Do hope you can be with us right through till 4 o'clock this afternoon.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So coming back to you, John, what do you make of Andrew and his sort of journey? Obviously interested in going to church, found something that he likes about the community, not ready though to sort of commit to actually believing in the things that they believe.
Full of admiration for Andrew. Andrew, congratulations, if I may say it without sounding patronising. I mean, it's just great that you are so open-minded and want to be part of a community where you find something real. I just think there ought to be many more kind of crossovers like that, where, you know, Christians go into places where faith isn't the norm and vice versa.
Absolutely.
Because it's those third spaces where you actually do dig into what makes, you know, real sense, what really you can live with and live by. So great that he does that. And Mark, I am absolutely with you on story as well. That just is so important. Can I tell one
please
kind of story, which I hesitate to say it, but I was at Eton College for 3 days earlier this year. And at the end, doing lectures and sermons and so on, and somebody apparently phoned the senior, a mother phoned the senior chaplain and said, who is the storytelling bishop you've just had at Eton? Because my son James says he's an ace cool dude.
Right.
Which is not something I would used to be expect to be called. But he says, she went on, and now he wants to be confirmed, you know, this song, which has annoyed his father. And it turned out the father was the senior vice president of the Republic of China. People's Republic of China. So I'm kind of, you can undermine, you know, a communist worldview through story. You know, story is a really powerful medium. We live in a sea of stories, you know, we're always telling stories. The culture tells stories, the newspapers, the adverts, you know, it's all stories. And it's a really great way. I mean, Jesus was there first.
Yes.
Always telling stories.
Mark didn't invent this, I don't think. But just tell us about a story that you've maybe shared with someone that's helped to them to rethink their worldview, I suppose, Mark. What have you found to be an effective sort of story to share?
Well, I mean, I use loads and loads of stories. But a story that I've been using recently is about the Emperor Tiberius. And the reason I use it is that he was a contemporary of Jesus. And apparently he was addicted to astrology. And on one occasion, he was living in Rhodes before he became the emperor, and astrologers would come to him, cast his horoscope, and then he would have them murdered. And the way he would do this, he would throw people off cliffs. And so one day an astrologer came to him, quaking in his boots, and was going to cast the horoscope for him. And Tiberius took him for a walk by the cliffs. And the astrologer was obviously desperately frightened. And Tiberius said to the astrologer, "What do you see in your stars right now?" And the astrologer said, "I know I'm in desperate, desperate danger."
Mm-hmm.
And Tiberius then said to him, "That's the right answer." And when he then became emperor, he made him the court astrologer. And this man effectively plotted with Tiberius. Anybody that Tiberius was worried about, this man would cast the horoscope, and then Tiberius would have these people executed if the horoscope was a bit odd or was too good.
Okay.
And what I explain to people is, Tiberius followed his stars, whereas I believe that we should follow Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm trying to do is to give people an insight into a world that perhaps they never thought about, and to try to help people to see that, in my view, everybody lives in a story, and that's why I believe everyone has faith in something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's actually very important in mission, where I think I might slightly disagree with you, Justin, and with John, that I think everybody has faith in something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it takes time to analyze what they have faith in. But when you look at Tiberius and what Josephus says about Tiberius, he clearly was a man of faith. But it wasn't faith in God or faith in Jesus. He had this very strong belief that fate governed everything he did. And because he believed that fate governed everything that he didn't believe he had any responsibility about his very dark side. And he was an extremely cruel emperor. He did throw people off cliffs, and he did kind of, you know, he was a very promiscuous man, and he abused children.
Mm.
But what's interesting about his story is that his belief in the stars and fate, that was the story he was living in. And I think that's a much, much more fruitful way of speaking about faith. Whereas I think perhaps the view you were taking, Justin, was that, you know, I have faith, but perhaps Andrew doesn't have
Well,
faith.
I was going to say, I mean, Andrew, would you ever describe what you have as faith in any sense in the way that Mark has just described it there?
I have faith in the inherent goodness of people. That's where I put my chips.
Okay.
The Quakers ran a fantastic advert in the Big Issue, and it's a picture of just a woman on the front saying, "Working for peace, finding God in everyone," and it's a brilliantly taken photograph. And it says, "Quakers, let your life speak." I'm happy with that sort of faith.
I mean, do you want to come in on this, John? And
yeah, I absolutely. That's where I want to start. You know, we start with creation rather than the fall.
Right.
You know, so creation, good. We are created, good. You know, I've just spent last night. I was with my 6-week-old grandson, and this little you know, gorgeous little being. You know, you can't talk about a whole pile of evil in that little life. On the other hand, I think one of the great things about Christianity to me is it's realistic about the dark side of mm-hmm. human nature as well.
Yeah.
And although it affirms strongly the glory of creation and the beauty of the world and God's love for his whole creation, this other side that keeps on coming through, whether it be as, you know, what's going on in Iraq at the moment, the appalling things there, or the cancer that killed a young friend of mine just a few weeks ago, only 38.
Or Emperor Tiberius or whoever.
An Emperor Tiberius, a tsunami, you know, whatever it is. The flaw keeps on coming through. And Christianity is realistic about that. And actually the cross is placed in the heart of all that negativity.
Yeah. I mean, obviously you believe in the inherent goodness, you say. You have faith in that, Andrew. I wonder, though, do you have faith that ultimately somehow humanity will get it right, that there will be a sort of, you know, that we aren't just... On a road to destruction in some way?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I think we probably all agree that the sun will expand and burn up all the life on this planet at some point in the future. But just to pick up on the inherent goodness of creation, when God made the Garden of Eden and placed Adam and created the universe, he said it was good. Because he's omniscient, surely he knew that Adam and Eve were going to fall. And how can he say it was good if he could know that all of this was going to happen in the future? So that would be my pushback on the fall and the omniscience of God. But I don't know if humanity's going to get it right. But what I'd say is if you look at how humanity starts to get it right is... By taking care of other human beings. That's how it's done. So I'm quite happy to do that and let God take care of the rest.
I mean, I'll go back to you, John, and then come to Mark, but this is, I think, a common question. You know, we acknowledge the evil that does exist, but why would God create a world in which he knew that was going to occur? I mean, whatever our theological understanding of the fall is, we live in a world in which presumably God created and allowed this evil to come into the world and to be part of this creation. So what possible justification would God have for that?
Because that's the radical justification of love. You know, love cannot operate in a way that controls. Love liberates, it gives freedom, etc. And the radical nature of God's love for his creation, or God's creation, it seems to me, is that he would say, I'm not controlling how this future is going to go. Here are the ingredients, and I'm with you, and I'm thoroughly working within the created order all the time. But I'm not like a plumber, kind of cosmic plumber, fixing it from outside. You know, here it is. Away we go. Also, though, not just winding it up at the start like a deistic kind of understanding of God, but a God who's utterly in the whole process, who underrules rather than overrules. But that's the nature of love. You know, love that actually would control the future is not love. If we are to have courage, if we are to have compassion, mercy, sacrifice, love, you know, the things that are worthwhile, you actually have to limit your own freedom. That's what God has done.
Self-limits in
the interest
of
love.
Creation. Mm. What do you make of that explanation, Andrew?
Well, there's a cartoon on the internet that sums up where it's Jesus knocking on the door saying, let me in, I'm here to save you. Mm-hmm. And the person says, save me from what? And Jesus says, save you from what I'll do to you if you don't let me in.
Right.
So a loving God that doesn't control, well, why does he mete out an infinite, terrible punishment just for the sin of not believing in him?
But I would say, Andrew, he really, really doesn't. I mean, I couldn't stand a God like that. I would just say I'm not interested in that kind of God or that kind of understanding of God. A God whose love is absolutely limitless, whose very essence is love, is who I believe in. I mean, the other side of that has to be that if you go against the ways of love, ultimately you come a cropper, I think. But it's not that God is saying, right, I'm going to make you come a cropper, I'm going to damage you, destroy you. You know, it's simply that if I step in front of a bus, I'm going to get damaged by it. And if you're in a created world, you know, that's the kind of cause and effect that you have. So, but a God who metes out punishment, no, thank you.
Let's get a quick take from Mark on this before we have to go to a break.
Well,
Mark.
I think one of the things I think you've got to do is you've got to probe how different worldviews look at the thing of evil. And if we think about Tiberius, yes, there are some people who would say, for example, that he's merely a machine and he can't help doing what he did. Mm. Then you've got other people who say it's his karma. He has a karma that means he has to do certain things. And then you've got other views that might say, it's all evil is an illusion. And I think the biblical story, as John was saying, it does realize that we do live in a very broken world where people can do very evil things. Yes, God gives us permission to do this, but it's part of the amazing teaching about the image of God, that because we are made in God's image, we are given a responsibility to be good stewards of creation. And God gives us this freedom, and we can rebel against this. But when you look at, I mean, what I've done is I've studied the lives of people like Tiberius and Caligula and Attila the Hun, and the evil is real, and there will come, in the Christian tradition, there will come a day when God will judge people. And that judgment, you know, we don't know everything about it, but people will have to give an account for the kind of cruelty and savagery that they've committed. And I do think it's knowing the full biblical story. It begins with a good creation, but God's purpose is to put his creation to rights, to restore and heal his creation. But judgment is part of that process.
We're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment's time. We're talking about how to explain your faith, and to help us do that, Andrew Nightingale is with us. He's an atheist, but he goes to church, and he's telling us about what he finds interesting, confusing, and maybe unbelievable about church and the Christian faith. And to help, as it were, give some answers or explanations is the Right Reverend John Pritchett, author of How to Explain Your Faith, and Mark Rock, also on the line, director of Reality Bites. I'm Justin Brierley. Join us again in just a moment's time for the second part of Unbelievable.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest edition, we give you 10 ways to grow your church in 2015 as we distill wisdom from leaders whose congregations are bursting at the seams. There's practical advice on how to get into scripture from John Pritchard. Plus, emerging church leader Brian McLaren and evangelical Andrew Wilson debate how Jesus read the Bible. All that plus news, reviews and your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. How to explain your faith. That's our subject today on Unbelievable. And we've got on the line Andrew Nightingale, who's our atheist guest. He's a regular listener of Unbelievable. And I've met up with Andrew in the past, and we've had good chats about what I believe, what he does or can't find a way to believe. But interestingly, has been going to church and part of a church community for a while. We're talking about explaining your faith. A very practical book by John Pritchard, who's my guest in studio today. He's the former Bishop of Oxford, but wrote this book, I think, about, 7 or 8 years ago, but it's been republished recently by SBCK. And Mark Rock also joins us on the line, director of Reality Bites, as we talk about explaining your faith. To come back to you, John, the kinds of questions that Andrew's been asking about, you know, how does this Christian worldview make sense? That I think one of the issues, and Andrew, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, is that because you've come across different ways of explaining Christianity, Andrew, it's left you thinking, well, is that right or is that right? You know, is there a sort of eternal conscious torment? Is that really what God has in store for people who don't believe him? Or is it more like what, you know, John over here says that he doesn't believe in it, that a God of love would do that sort of to someone? And then there is all manner of other, you know, contentious controversies. Is this part of what makes it difficult for you to believe that, in that sense, Andrew, that there are different perspectives within the Christian tradition?
I watch carefully how the church treats liberal or progressive Christians. They tend to get kicked out of the community for going liberal. And that is, that to me shows what Christians, or what they're supposed to believe about heaven and hell and all the other stuff. David Robertson wrote that there are Christian atheists out there. And just and there is a right and a wrong way to worship God. And it's this, it's getting my, it looks like people, are, it's made to look simple that you just have to give your life to Jesus. Then after you've done that, you get all the small things.
The small print.
So, and you know what I'm talking about. And this happened, young people, they accepted, and everyone wants to be accepted into a group, into a community, and surrounded by love. And this, I think this is often used to crowbar in political views to people who come to church, and they're then, obviously they've got the risk of being excluded from that community that they've entered. And this is, and looking at the way that that progressive and liberal Christians are spoken to online, it is quite telling.
Okay, so you find that there seems to be a certain sort of a line beyond which, if you digress from it, you're sort of treated as an outcast, at least by some aspects of the church. Any answers for this, John? I mean, I suppose partly I'm wondering, is there just a simple point at which we can all agree, and then we say, well, the rest is small print, and we're entitled to our different perspectives on that.
You know, there was a book called Christianity in History that I read when I was at Oxford, it was written by a professor of history from Cambridge, and the very last sentence was, "Hold fast to Christ, and for the rest, be totally uncommitted." And I've always found that really helpful. You know, I want to hold fast to Christ as that key, that kind of locking nut that makes sense of the whole. And for the rest, I'll be uncommitted. H.G. Wells, again, saying, look, I'm a historian, I'm not a believer, but I have to say, as a historian, this penniless preacher from Galilee is irresistibly the centre of history. Mm. It's that locking nut that I stick with. But I agree that, when you move from God and faith into religion and institution, you can get all kinds of distortions. Mm. And where people can get trapped into their little institutional worldviews and their conservative defensive positions. And that's what you get when people are excluding each other. Jesus, for heaven's sake, he was constantly breaking open all these boundaries and saying, no, let them in. You know, whoever they are, let them in. It's all part of God's family. Can I just say one other thing? Mm-hmm. It just, to me, the question is, what is the scale of the God we're talking about? If we're dealing with a petty, little, flat pack, do-it-yourself, off-the-shelf kind of family-size God, oh, for heaven's sake, I'm not interested in that. But a God let's start at another point. Light has been coming towards us from the Big Bang, 13.7 mm-hmm. billion years ago, at the speed of 186,000 miles per second mm-hmm. for 13.7 billion years. This is a large universe, Now, the God I'm talking about is the God who underscores, who holds together, who is the context for that. Yeah. So this little kind of do-it-yourself family pat God, just isn't in it. And the defensiveness that we show as Christians sometimes against, people who have a slightly different view, it's just sad.
But you've presided over probably countless confirmations in your time, John, as a bishop. And in a sense, what that does is it affirms certain truths. So when you say Christ is central and then everything else, I'm uncommitted, if you like. But there are commitments, aren't there? Basic commitments, I suppose, that kind of tell us what Christianity consists of.
We do our best with words, don't we, and with concepts. But concepts are second-order stuff. That's why this storytelling thing is so important. The primary language of faith is about prayer and worship and song and story and, parable and poetry and so on. The second-order language is the kind of systematics, when you start putting it together and making some sense of it. And that's when you get all kinds of problems can set in, as we say, well, my understanding is better than your understanding, etc. So there are statements we want to make, but I think they need to be statements that hold to Christ, as I say, that hold to essentials. And then the rest is work in progress. We're trying to understand the incomprehensible God,
Well, let's talk about Jesus. I mean, at that level, Andrew, do you find yourself drawn to this character, Jesus, or does he throw up just as many questions as you find about other issues in the Christian faith?
I think Jesus gets good PR amongst atheists in general. Gandhi summed it up. You know, I like your Christ, I don't like your Christians. Mm. Most of my friends are Christians, so I'm not. But that's to paraphrase the issue. It's what people do, and they use God to kind of justify and avoid responsibility for their actions.
Yeah. Do you want to come in, Mark?
Well, I think I just like a few comments about. I think, you know, talking about how we can share faith. One of the things I will say to people is those people who follow Jesus will never die. Because at the resurrection, we will live in a new heavens and a new earth, and we will slide down the necks of a brontosaurus. Now, I say that because I want to evoke perhaps a different way of looking at the future, not just to kind of music in heaven, but a whole, I mean, John's pointed to this, the whole creation being set free. Mm-hmm. And I believe that when we do mission, if you can get people to see that the purpose of the coming of Christ is to have our sins forgiven, which I think is important, but also to actually liberate the creation from all that is oppressive and dark and evil. So this image in Isaiah is the lion will lie down with a lamb. And in my way, I tell a story about a man who used to swim with a crocodile. And it's just an incredible story about a friendship between a man and a crocodile. And that's evoking through a story something of the future. But I do also think we need to be concerned about doctrine. Mm-hmm. I want to be careful how I say this. Because in my work as a teacher, I have met Christians who basically haven't got hold of basic orthodox teaching, but are basically using very New Age kind of perspectives. Mm-hmm. For example, there's a course, I think called A Course in Miracles, which is quite a well-known course used by churches, that is very, very different from Orthodox Christian teaching.
Okay.
And so I do think it's important to have a sensitivity to issues of doctrine. I don't think you can get rid of that. This course basically teaches that we human beings are really part of the Godhead. We are not individual sinners made in God's image, but rather we are part of God. And so sin for these people is a complete illusion, a fabrication. And really, it's about ignorance, that we've lost touch with the fact that we are part of God. And the whole process of redemption is us discovering that we really are God.
Right.
Now, there are lots and lots of kind of pantheistic kind of perspectives like this. And I think, you know, if you know the biblical narrative, which speaks of a good creation but a fall and then redemption, you have to be able to challenge those kind of Gnostic distortions of the Christian faith.
I mean, what do you do in these instances that Mark describes, John? Because one of the chapters in the book is called Life in a Spiritual Supermarket, and you talk about the fact that many people are searching for spirituality. I don't think people are perhaps any less spiritual than they used to be. They're just a bit less, they're more wary, at least, of organised religion and so on. So very often I think Christianity can appear to be very sort of regulated, and people say, oh, well, I'm not interested in that, I just want spirituality. And maybe that's what Mark's almost referring to there in terms of the directions that can take us off in.
And it often seems to me that the whole New Age world is actually not about the transcendent at all, but it's just about ourselves. You know, it's about some form of self-affirmation and building up our own personal confidence and credibility. So that's not to say all other spiritualities are like that, but I think the important thing is not to to pick and mix all over the place, but to say this is my starting point. For me, you know, I hold fast to Christ. Mm-hmm. That's what's made absolute sense to me, and I will offer that to other people without saying, This is how I see it. I'm not telling you that that's the way you've got to see it. I'm saying I think this makes most sense of most things most of the time, etc. All that I've said before. So it's trying to take seriously a faith tradition rather than taking bits and pieces to make my own faith. You know, constructing our own faith it's what we're doing all the time at the moment, trying to make our own lives, you know, construct our own reality. And actually the reality that we have is given to us, I think, by God.
Yeah.
And in that reality, I think the Christian faith is the revelation that makes sense to me. So I want to offer that. And I want to say to people, don't go mucking around, you know, trying to take a bit here and a bit there and so on. go deep into the faith that has actually shaped this nation, this culture, this Western world, which, what's the figure, 2.3 billion Christians around the world take seriously. You know, look at that seriously. Don't think you've got to go off and be clever and make your own faith up. That's going to be self-defeating.
What's your response, Andrew?
Well, I'd be interested to know how John formed his opinion about New Age practices. I'm not a fan myself, but have you spoken to New Age practitioners, and for how long? Have you actually tried immersing yourself in their culture and being outnumbered and spent time with them without agenda?
Mm-hmm.
It's really easy for me to demonise Christians if I just go, I need to go on the internet and I can find all I need to demonise them. But when I spend time with Christians without agenda, just going for a walk, not even talking about God, then that allows me to build a better picture up.
Very good question, Andrew, and I fully accept that charge, as it were, and you're right, I haven't done that. I am relying on what I read and what I see, which I suppose we do about most things in life, really. We don't actually experience from the inside what it's like to have been in 1914, you know, in the place I'm immersed in much of my reading at the moment. But you're absolutely right. I haven't done that, and therefore it is secondhand that I'm relaying. But I do still think that this starting where you are, instead of trying to create your own reality out of the bits and pieces that are around, is a better approach to truth than pulling bits and pieces around.
I mean, you've obviously, I'm guessing, Andrew, you've chosen, you know, maybe it was by dint of, you know, wanting to get in the magazine originally, but you've chosen to be part of this church community. You haven't, I guess, gone down the road to the mosque or to the Buddhist temple or wherever. But is that for you just a sort of an accident of circumstance? And as an atheist, you'll have to say it is, in as much as you don't see any guiding sort of force there in terms of the journey you've taken thus far.
I do go to the Buddhist Center once a month, and I don't see there might be a guiding purpose that took me to church, but you know, at the same time there was probably a mosquito that doesn't have free will that landed on a child and gave it malaria. No free will involved, but what guiding force led that there? Does that lead me to Jesus and God, or could it be another God? You know, that's not something that really concerns me. At the end of the day, it's I think what's kept me there is this: it's so easy to form an ungenerous view of outgroups or people who aren't us. The only way around that is to spend time with them. And that's what's held me there.
And that's what I admire so much, Andrew, if I may say, you know, that you're in that space, and great, and I haven't done that. Though, and of course, I'm not saying that about Buddhists or Muslims, you know, I'm talking about New Age as the agglomeration of different spiritualities. But I have some very good Buddhist friends, Muslim friends, particularly in Oxford, you know, where we were doing an awful lot together interfaith stuff, because you know, Muslims have so often been really pleased that there is a Church of England that's actually standing in the public square for faith. And we had so much more in common than we actually had different from each other. So, but you have done more than I have, and good for you.
I mean, Andrew, before we come back to Mark, do you feel like, you know, if you could find a resolution to some of the questions you have, that Christianity would be an option? Do you feel like you would want to have what these other people you spend a lot of time with talk about in terms of a relationship with God through Jesus Christ?
Well, I'd be interested if anyone says I don't have a relationship with God, I'd refer them to Romans 14, and that's when the whole chapter about how you talk about the faith of other people. So, you know, Paul warns against criticizing people of weaker faith or different faith from you. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of Dave Tomlinson, because he spent time outside of his comfort zone and given it a lot of thought. And I think the problem comes back to after being, you know, being a Christian, and then you get given the small print afterwards. You have to carry.
It sounds like you're very worried about signing up to something which you're somehow going to be committed to long term.
Yeah,
Andrew.
Here's a question. When people are talking to people about their faith, and I include atheists here, why are they doing it? You know, is it just to bring them round to their way of thinking so that they're right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it to try and... So if you had a choice of convincing someone that your politics were right,
mm-hmm.
or that your faith was right, but they could go off and be a universalist or a liberal progressive Christian... Because you've got to be careful what you wish for. A lot of atheists are liberals. So if you convert someone, you might end up creating a liberal Christian, and you might not want that. I don't know what your listenership's like.
If I had a cure for cancer, you know, I just want to offer it to people rather than file it away under sea. If I went to see The Imitation Game just recently, you know, great film. I want to talk about it and commend it to others. So if the Christian faith is the best thing I've found, you know, I can't not want to share it, not to ram it down people's throats as people talk about. But, you know, here is something enormously liberating to me. Life in all its fullness, you know, life in technicolor. You know, I've just loved being a Christian in this fascinating, amazing world. With all its brokenness, and that's what I want to offer. So I think that would be my answer, Andrew. You know, I want to talk about that faith because it is the best thing I've found, but not in a way that's coercive in any sense.
It sounds a bit like part of your concern, let's say, Andrew, is that if I were to sign on any dotted line, if you like, I'd be somehow signing that I am now this type of a person with this type of a politics and all the rest of it. Now, I guess, yep. I guess, in a way, the question is, personally, from my perspective, I would say, what you do, what where God takes you after that, is not something that the person who perhaps engenders the faith in another person has any control over. And so, at the end of the day, you know, I guess, start from what you know as the most basic thing. If there is a relationship with Christ to be had, then take it, and then see what happens afterwards. But any thoughts on this, Mark?
Well, I mean, the first thing is I personally, I have had debates with people who have, with teachers, you know, a course in miracles, and it was one of the most amazing bits of education I was involved in, where for 10 weeks I would explain what I thought was the Orthodox Christian perspective, and then my friend David would explain a course in miracles. And on the final session, we had about 150 sixth formers, and we were debating about what we thought, who we thought Jesus was, and the bell went for dinner, and we went 15 minutes over. So the 150 students were absolutely gripped by a discussion about Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's good mission. But I did have to talk about the fact that he said, you know, the world is an illusion.
Mm.
And he repeatedly said this. And he repeatedly said that Jesus is not the savior of the world. He is just another teacher.
Right.
And his worldview basically boiled down to a kind of, there are spirit guides who are enlightening us. And the core of the teaching is one of reincarnation. I think that's a very important issue for Christians and non-Christians to think about, is different views of the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a really profound difference between believing in karma and believing in Jesus. And the way I put it to people is, with karma, you get what you deserve, rebirth in a rat or a crocodile or whatever. But with Christ, you get the forgiveness of your sins and the hope of the resurrection body. And I do think there is a difference between those two worldviews, and it's important to help people to think that through.
I guess Andrew recognises that's, if you like, at the basis of the Christian worldview, as opposed to any other story we might live in, as you say. I mean, but then his concern is, well, what else am I sort of being required to sign up to if I take this option? And Mark, what's your perspective on that, in terms of, are you committed to a particular political view, or again, I don't know, I'm guessing it's issues like homosexuality and eternal yeah. salvation and those kinds of things that kind of make Andrew think, do I want to be part of this?
Well, I do think I want to bring up the thing of wisdom, and I think that we Christians are called to be discerning about loads of different issues, and there are lots of different issues that require thinking, that require thought. But for me, when you come to believe that Jesus is Lord, you want to live in that story. It is, of course, true that there are people who have, as it were, made that story pretty unattractive. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a big issue. But for me, it's the beginning that Jesus Christ is Lord. And then we have to start thinking about what does that mean. Yeah, and I do think there are implications for politics. I do think there are implications for economics, for the way we do underwater basket weaving. I'm being serious in that I do think there are implications of the gospel for all different areas of life. But sometimes that requires a difficult and, you know, complicated conversation. And I think that one of the things I hear from Andrew is that Christians aren't always willing to have those conversations, and I think he's making a good point there.
Yeah. Andrew, anything to add to that?
Yeah, Jesus spent his life with sinners and out-groups, and so if Christians spend most of their time with other Christians in their in-group, in that sense, in that singular sense, that's not following that example of Jesus. I've spent the last 6 years immersing myself in my out-group, which was Christians, and it's been fantastic.
Yeah.
So I would encourage. I know it's difficult because go to the Sunday assembly if you want. That's a kind of churchy environment, and you will be meeting. You'll see how they react. I sometimes get that look going. Oh no, are you? What sort of Christian are you? Or you know, I want to tell them I go to church. Go to the Atheist Society, and you might have to be, you know, keep your mouth shut for a bit, but just see what the people are like. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
Christians and atheists share a lot of things in common. They care deeply.
Do you find that when you actually obviously get people face to face rather than on an internet discussion board, it changes the game a bit as well, I'm guessing?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And one of the good things, I think, about the new atheism that Richard Dawkins and the others have been introducing us to, is that it has made these debates real again. Mm. And they're not under the surface now. We can have proper discussion. Actually, you know, I've found being a bishop in a public arena has taken me into loads of fascinating discussions where people are much more open about the fact that I'm not a believer, but, you know, then we talk. Mm. When I was a vicar, we had a group called No Holds Barred, and it was where there were no right or wrong answers. You know, people would come if they were hanging on to faith or interested in faith or falling out of faith or whatever. And it's 25 years on, it's still going, you know, because that's the third space. It's not in, it's not out, it's where you actually can discuss. These are really important places.
If you were to give a bit of advice to Andrew, if he was interested in stepping into, putting his toe a bit further into this this Christian pool, what would it be? He's doing a lot already, and all credit to Andrew for that. But if Andrew was thinking, if I was to take a step of quote unquote faith, what would be your advice to him, John?
Well, I think it would be kind of arrogant to make any suggestion there. Apart from, you know, Andrew is in there. He's in the community. He's thinking. Mm. I mean, if it makes sense, great. If it doesn't make sense, that's also right. You know, I think our first allegiance is to truth. I think that because I believe that Jesus is the way, the truth and the life, that, you know, if you pursue the truth, you bump into Jesus at some point.
Okay.
So I think that's what I just would suggest. Andrew just keeps on the journey. But if it doesn't make sense, his allegiance must be to the fact that it doesn't make sense.
Right.
Can I tell a story?
Go for it. Yeah.
It's that the life of Pi. Do you remember the film and the book. And so on? And there's an extraordinary story, if anyone doesn't know it, that there's a shipwreck at sea, and young Pi loses his family, but he finds himself on a lifeboat with a Bengal tiger called Richard Parker. And the story is about how they live together on this lifeboat. It's just crazy, in a sense. And he just about escapes, Pi does, with his life. And at the end, he's in a hospital recovering, and two insurance agents are listening to the story he tells about what's happened, about he's lived with this on this lifeboat with this Bengal tiger. And at the end, you can see they don't believe a word of it. So he tells them another story, a very conventional story about you know, human evilness. And at the end of it, he says, "So which story do you prefer?" You know, and that's the question I think Christians must put to the culture. Which story makes more sense to you?
Yeah.
It's not avoiding the question of truth. It's saying, do you recognise truth in all levels, intellectual truth, personal truth, social truth? You know, do you recognise that in this story or not? If you don't, then it's no good trying to get you to live by it, because you'll be living a lie. So I don't think I want Andrew to live a lie. I want him to keep going on that journey.
We're going to take another quick break, and then we'll be wrapping up today's conversation on how to explain your faith. And it's ranged far and wide, but my guests today, Right Reverend John Pritchard, Andrew Nightingale and Mark Rock. I'm Justin Brierley. Join me again for the final part of Unbelievable, part of Faith Explored, every Saturday afternoon on Premier Christian Radio in just a moment's time. Welcome back for the final part of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, and the final Unbelievable of 2014. And I hope you've had a good year. And if you want to look back on the vast archive of programmes, including all of those from 2014, then do visit the Unbelievable webpage at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And of course, you can obtain the DVD of this year's Unbelievable, the conference. That's worth getting your hands on if you've got some spending money post-Christmas that you'd like to do something with, then why not order the Unbelievable Conference DVD and CD with some 13 hours of audio and video from this year's conference. That's at premierchristianradio.com/DVD specifically if you want that one, but it's also you can find that from the Unbelievable webpage. Lots of people, of course, comment nowadays on the programmes. With the new look website, you're able to leave your comments underneath individual programmes across the year. And so we'll be bringing some of those comments as well as your emails towards the end of today's programme. We're also going to be hearing about what's coming up in 2015 in terms of live events for Unbelievable. So stay tuned to hear more about that. Later on today, between 4 and 5, Charmaine Noble MacLean speaks to none other than Anne Graham Lotz. She is the daughter of famed evangelist Billy Graham, of course, but she's going to be speaking to Charmaine about her own life and faith. So you'll want to hear that between 4 and 5 this afternoon. And if you're back again at the same time next week, what's coming up on Unbelievable? Well, in the first show of 2015, we're going to be talking about hell, something we do on a semi-regular basis. We're going to be having a discussion on two views of hell. One is eternal conscious torment, the idea that hell is an everlasting, eternal place of torment. The other being the annihilationist, or sometimes called conditional immortality view, that in fact hell involves an extinction of those who are lost. So two guests, quite high profile guests, join me for that. One being Al Mohler. He is the president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And he, of course, is well known for being a writer, a speaker, an author on conservative Christianity. He's going to be defending, as you might expect, the eternal conscious torment view of hell. Al has a popular daily podcast called The Briefing. And earlier on this year, he actually talked about the issue of eternal conscious torment versus annihilationism. And we're going to be hearing from an annihilationist in the form of Chris Date. He's been on the programme before. He's one of the founders of the Rethinking Hell website, and he became convinced several years ago that in fact annihilationism is the correct way of interpreting scriptures when it comes to hell. So that's the debate that will kick us off in 2015. Right now, though, it's time to get back into our discussion on how to explain your faith.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So as we conclude our discussion on explaining your faith, we haven't managed to touch on much of what's actually in the book, though I think parts of what we've spoken of certainly do apply to some of the chapters in your book, John. You cover things like, is there anybody there? The God I don't believe in. Science has all the answers today. The big one, suffering. Jesus who? What use is a dying God? And much more. Some really practical, useful stuff in this republished edition of How to Explain Your Faith. Let's start with you, Andrew. We were talking just as we had to close out that last section about John giving you, you know, perhaps a little nudge in the direction of keep on the journey, keep looking for truth, and so on. Do you feel like you're going to get anywhere? Do you feel like you're any closer than you were when you first stepped into that church to knowing if there's something in this Christianity malarkey?
Yeah. Since reading Dave Tomlinson's books, that's just made sense.
Okay.
Of the issue, really. So, it's a journey. You know, to quote Brian McLaren, we make the road by walking. So, yeah.
All right. It's been very good having you on the program today and telling us a bit about your situation, Andrew, and how it all works at the moment for you. Mark, just as we start to close proceedings, you've talked about the importance of story. What is it about, as it were, using illustrations, parables, stories that for you does something better than just, as it were, presenting this is what Christians believe and this is what we'd like you to believe, as it were?
Well, I think it's to do with the imagination, and it's to do with the way I think God has made us, that we operate very much on this narrative level of stories. When we hear about a guy who, George Müller, who basically put through school and college 10,000 orphans, and he used to pray all the time, and during his lifetime he received about £1,450,000. And it was because people would come up to him and say, Mr. Müller, I must give you 10 shillings.
Mm. This was back in, what, the 1800s or something?
Well, the 1800s. He basically set up these orphanages in Bristol. But what's incredible is when you look into the story, you find it's an amazing story of faith in action. And that, you know, loads of people would come up to him and give him £2,000. And this happened repeatedly throughout the whole of his life. And I think that when you find out there are stories like this happening in Africa. Mm. I've got somebody I know who has adopted 1,700 orphans.
Mm.
And money, again with the Müller story, money just arrives from all over the world. I think that's a much more powerful way of talking about Christian truth than giving people a version of the ontological argument.
You could try that as well, but
the point I'm making is that I think that stories they bear witness to the truth. And a story I've just been discovering is a question I ask people: is why did the gladiator games begin, and how did they end?
Mm.
And it's just fascinating why people started the gladiatorial combats, but how they ended is amazing.
Okay,
it was a Christian man in 400 AD. Who was in the Colosseum, who was so shocked by the gladiators killing each other, he stepped down into the Colosseum and said to these men, stop fighting, in the name of Christ, it's evil. The crowd stoned him to death because he was interfering with their entertainment. And within a few years, the games had stopped completely. And I think that story, the Müller story, and that story, it speaks about people who love God, love their neighbors, and that you see the fruit of it. And I think that's the most kind of powerful way of doing apologetics.
Sure. Mm. Interesting stuff. Thank you very much for being with us as well, Mark. Realitybites.org.uk for more of Mark's stories and the way he brings a Christian perspective to many secular audiences around the world. John, thanks again for being in studio with us. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation.
My pleasure. It's been really good. That kind of conversation is meat and drink to me. And I just really hope that more Christians will take that risk of actually thinking their faith through so that they can really enter those conversations with a bit more confidence.
And like Andrew has done, I suppose, stepping out of their own comfort zones and meeting people in these third spaces.
Absolutely. And not being afraid when people say on Monday morning, so what did you do at the weekend? You know, and actually say, yeah, I went to church. And you know, be public about being Christian and get into the conversations that leads to.
And be prepared to give some answers as well. And a good way of doing that is to pick up a copy of the book, How to Explain Your Faith. I think it's just really good introduction, practical way of looking at some of these big questions. But been great to have you on the programme, John.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for being with us. And thank you for listening. And if you want more information on any of our guests, Andrew, Mark and the Right Reverend John Pritchard, then do go to the website of today's programme. You can leave a comment there as well and see what you thought of today's show. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, thanks to everyone who's been getting in touch, and we'll be reading some of your feedback in just a moment's time, both by email and those who have left comments in regard to recent programmes on the website as well. Just a brief mention that if you're wondering what's happening regarding Unbelievable, the conference in 2015, well, the news is that we're not actually putting on a conference this coming year in terms of the big scale apologetics conference that we normally put on in central London. We felt for a variety of reasons that it was a year to pause that and come back stronger than ever in 2016. One of the reasons being that my wife is expecting at around the time that the conference would normally be taking place, and so that and other factors have meant that we felt it would not be the best thing to do this year. However, We are aiming to put on a live event. Indeed, what we're aiming to do in the early part of May, in fact, is to put on effectively a live version of this programme. That'll make it very cost effective, and it'll make it possible for many people to come and enjoy an evening of unbelievable live, as it were. So we're still working out the details of that. We're going to have a fantastic debate for you, basically, though, that I'll be chairing, and you'll be able to come along if you're in the London area or if you're able to travel for that event. More details early in January about what that will consist of. So watch this space, as they say, and look out for an event coming along your way in early May. If you are interested in getting along to a specifically apologetics training event, though, then I can highly recommend what's coming up in January, put on by RZIM, Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. They're holding a training day on Saturday, the 24th of January. It's happening at St Mary's Church, Bryanston Square, Wyndham Place, York Street, London, from 9:30 in the morning till 5 in the evening. It's £17.50 per person, or £10 for those who are unwaged. And some great speakers there, going to be hearing from Vince Vitale, Tom Price, Tanya Walker, Simon Edwards and Becky Manley Pippett on subjects like design in the universe, thinking about reason, God and morality, history in Jesus and personal experience. So if you want to find out more about that, visit the events section of the rzim.eu website. That's rzim.eu. And I'm fully supporting the conference there that they're having, the Reasons for God conference, it's called, Saturday the 24th of January in London. Okay, well, let's go to some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme. And we had last week a discussion on Isaiah, specifically chapter 7, and whether Isaiah predicted the virgin birth, whether he was talking about Mary and the coming of Jesus when it came to this interesting but somewhat cryptic prophecy that's often invoked at Christmas for the coming of Jesus. It was, of course, Matthew in his gospel who used it as a way of suggesting that this was about a virgin conceiving and bearing a son. Of course, in the original, as it were, Hebrew in Isaiah, it talks about a young woman giving birth, and she shall call him Emmanuel, not Jesus. And so we had an interesting discussion between my two guests, Alistair McKittrick, who's a theologian and tutor at Moorlands Bible College, and Robert Stovold, an atheist skeptic, who has written a book about Christmas from that perspective. And they had, I thought, quite a fruitful discussion on how to interpret this particular passage from Isaiah. And Alistair bring a really interesting perspective on how Matthew adapts and reinterprets that passage for his audience, and to speak about the wider messianic implications of Jesus. So here's some of the feedback to that. Here's Rich, who says, "I was bemused by Robert Stovold's attempts to actually find a line of argumentation. It amounted to no more than, I'm not a believer, so any argument for prophecy is moving the goalposts. On the one hand, he's an unbeliever. On the other hand, he tries to lecture Christians that they're violating the scripture's prophetic voice when the scripture's own prophetic voice gives explanation to the near and final fulfillment of much prophecy. Has he never read 2 Timothy, 2 Peter or Hebrews? He doesn't have to believe them, but he cannot mount an internal critique on Christianity for moving theological goalposts when this is what we have believed since the foundations of the Christian religion were laid. Further, Stovall wants to tell us that God must be crystal clear with how prophecy will unfold, but then whines when our scriptures from Isaiah and Christ tell us the opposite. That's not goalpost moving, Robert. You're just a bad theologian. If all Stovall wanted to demonstrate was that he doesn't believe in prophecy and supernaturalism, and therefore Christianity is not true, then he succeeded in telling us what we already knew," says Rich. Thank you very much. Coming in under the show online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, a few people weighed in with their thoughts as well. COD said, "That's pretty much what theology is. It starts from an a priori conclusion and seeks anything that'll back it up. It's the exact opposite of how science works. I don't understand Alistair's suggestion that the mother of Emmanuel is Zion. He thinks that interpretation makes the Septuagint mistranslation of Alma as virgin understandable, but I don't see why the image of Zion should be a virginal woman per se. In fact, I couldn't find any use of a woman as Zion or Jerusalem at all in chapters preceding Isaiah. 7. I also don't understand both Alistair and Robert thinking that Emmanuel and Mahershala Hashbaz, a great biblical name, have to be the same kid. You're speaking here of the prophecy specifically in Isaiah and who this child is that's being referred to. It seems likely to me that Meher is Emmanuel's younger brother. The destruction of Syria in Israel is supposed to happen before Emmanuel's age of accountability, but also before little Meher even learns to speak, making Emmanuel older by about a decade, if 12 or so is taken as the age of accountability. Alistair also had an objection that Isaiah's children are merely signs and have to point to someone else, but they can be signs of events they predict and don't have to point to any other person. Okay, there's also rather a technical entry here by an anonymous commentator on the Septuagint, and this was regarding the nature of the translation that Matthew was working from, apparently, when he was putting his gospel story together about the birth of Christ and so on. I'll read some of this because it is quite interesting. The original Septuagint was a translation only of the Torah, the five books of Moses. It was done during the reign of Ptolemy II Philadelphus, 285 to 246 BCE. Sometime thereafter, the books of the prophets, writings, and other books not found in the Tanakh were translated to Greek, and eventually all came to be called the Septuagint. This was done over the next few centuries, and some Septuagint type of Greek translations were found in Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls. No one knows who translated the prophets and writings into Greek. It probably was done by Jews, as Jews in some communities used them. Jews stopped using them early because of their inaccuracies, but Christians used them much longer, although most eventually gave up on them. The Encyclopedia Judaica says it is certain that all sorts of scribal changes led to many differences, some substantial, between what the codices contain and what the earliest Greek or Old Greek read. A reasoned and important conclusion from an analysis of all this material is that what we term the Septuagint is in fact an almost accidental gathering together of texts from diverse sources. Anyway, that's an interesting perspective on the so-called sort of Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures that Matthew would have been working from. And I think it's helpful in some ways in talking about the way he uses the Isaiah passage. But anyway, going on to Johannes, who wanted to say Alistair justified the use of Parthenos, virgin, by the author of Matthew, by pointing out that the same translation is used in the Septuagint. I'm not sure he justified it that way, actually, in the programme. I think he believed that Matthew had his own separate reasons for believing that virgin was a good way of taking this passage from Isaiah and repurposing it. But anyway, you say the most likely reason is that the author was himself a Hellenized Jew who was familiar with the Greek translation, but less so with the Hebrew texts. He just quotes Isaiah how he knew it. That exonerates him of the charge of having deliberately misrepresented Isaiah in this respect, although changing Isaiah from "she will call his name Emmanuel" to "they will call his name Emmanuel" still looks like theologically motivated redaction. But what does this say with regards to divine inspiration of the text? Should we really believe that a text where a central theological statement is misconstrued due to a sloppy translation is actually inspired by the all-powerful creator of the universe? I think this is a dead giveaway that the Emmanuel reference was not inspired by any supernatural being, but is a product of the author's own theological views, says Johannes. Okay, well, that's your perspective on that, Johannes. Though I do seem to remember in that discussion that the point was that Matthew wouldn't necessarily have had to be restricted to just using the Septuagint, but that he, for whatever reason, felt that this was the way he wanted to reinterpret, as it were, that passage from the book of Isaiah. Anyway, thank you very much for getting in touch. Let's go to some of your other thoughts on the programme before that. A very well-received programme between Keith Ward, a theist philosopher, and Michael Roos, an atheist philosopher. It's always great fun when you get them on together because they're both great characters and they had a really fantastic interaction. In fact, I had lots of very appreciative tweets about that. Here's one from Keith Mason, who said of their discussion on the existence of God, "Thank you for your episode with Keith Ward and Michael Roos. I learned a great deal and would love to hear them talk again." And Andrew Nightingale, who of course we heard on the programme today, said, "Couldn't agree more. I'd buy tickets to hear them debate in the pub." And Andy Walton also expressing similar sentiments that he really enjoyed that show when it arrived in his MP3 feed. Okay, there was a little bit of a delay getting that show up onto iPods and so on. So I had lots of appreciative messages when it did finally arrive, including this one from Michael Brady, who said the show has arrived on iTunes and it was delightful. If ever there were two fascinating fellows with whom having a pint or two would be a true pleasure, Professors Ward and Roos would be at the top of my list. In the course of my studies, I greatly enjoyed and recommend Ward's Christianity, A Short Introduction. And another Michael said, brilliant show, just brilliant. Your two guests together brought dusty old arguments alive and both showed just how gentlemanly these discussions can be. Now, here's a little bit of the to and fro that went on in the comments section underneath that show between Michael Roos and Keith Ward. Freddie Fritz said, the best argument for God is the fact that there is something rather than nothing. The best argument against God, the long, messy and violent process that led to the relatively recent arrival of human beings. Derek responded by saying, it intrigues me why nothing should be seen as the default state. And therefore, it is surprising that there is something. There has been stuff around for a long time. Perhaps something should be seen as the default, at least until someone can give us good reason to believe that nothing really is more likely. To which Freddie Fritz responded, if something exists, I think it needs an explanation. I don't see how nothing would require an explanation. It's one of those ones that quickly gets into all kinds of linguistic hoops, doesn't it? But anyway, COD then weighed in and said, first, you need a good definition of nothing. Then, since we know that something actually exists, you need to ask yourself if you have good reasons to assume that nothing could exist, much less that it is somehow the default state. Yeah, as you can see, because of the nature of nothing, it quickly lends itself to getting into interesting linguistic problems. But yeah, just one of those areas where obviously our old friend Lawrence Krauss has tripped over once or twice in terms of his definitions of nothing and so on. Thanks very much for getting in touch anyway underneath that programme in regards to that discussion on the existence of God. Lots of people who appreciated it. If you want to leave a thought or a comment underneath any shows, including today's, then do go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can go back through the archive. You can see what other people have said about past shows. You can leave a comment there yourself. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes or via some other RSS feeder. We did update our podcast feed, our MP3 feed, in the latter part of 2014, and that had one or two technical issues as we started to use a new provider. Most of those problems have been ironed out. I think we're still experiencing one or two for some people who have had difficulty downloading the shows, but I hope that that's getting better for you, and hopefully that will provide a more stable feed as well for those who are regular listeners of the show. And my thanks to everyone who has been downloading so faithfully the show for years and years now. We regularly pop up in the iTunes top 10 in religion and spirituality. In fact, I happened to click on the top 10 list earlier this week and see that we were number one, at least for a short time anyway. And I'm going to say that counts as a Christmas number one for Unbelievable. So thanks to all who do regularly download the programme. Thanks also, though, of course, to you who listen every Saturday via the normal method of the radio set. So it's great to have you, whether you're listening online, via podcast, or on air, and we hope for a great 2015 to come as well. So look forward to what's coming up in coming editions of the programme. You can expect in 2015 some great debates. So we've got the Case for Christian Humanism coming up. That's with Angus Ritchie opposite Stephen Law, who's a fairly well-known atheist philosopher here in the UK. And Angus Ritchie is one of the authors of a new Theos publication on why Christians should believe in humanism and humanists in Christianity. So I know that Stephen Law has taken exception with that publication, and that'll be a really interesting debate between the two of them. We're going to be having John Loftus and David Marshall debating as well. Those are two names in Christian apologetics and online atheism that are familiar to many people. And we're also excited to say that a short way into 2015, we're going to be bringing you a debate between William Lane Craig and atheist philosopher Daniel Kame on the unusual effectiveness of mathematics. It's an argument for the existence of God that Bill Craig, who's a well-known Christian philosopher, has been using more and more in debates and presentations on the existence of God. And he's going to be putting it to the test with atheist philosopher Daniel Kame in a couple of weeks' time. So that should be a really interesting one to watch out for on your iPod feed and on air as well. But what's coming up next week? Let me tell you that right now.
You're unbelievable.
We're going to be doing that debate on hell next week, and we're going to be joined by a real well-known name in conservative theology. He is Dr. Al Mohler. He is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He has a popular daily programme called The Briefing, and in a recent edition of that, he criticised the annihilationist perspective on hell. He certainly holds to the traditional eternal conscious torment view. Well, he's going to be debating that with an up-and-coming, if you like, advocate of the annihilationist or conditional immortality perspective. That is Chris Date. He's the author of the book Rethinking Hell, or at least he's one of the editors of a collected number of readings around conditional immortality. And he's also one of the founders of the Rethinking Hell website. So they'll be debating conditionalism and eternal conscious torment, same time, same place, next week here on Unbelievable, 2:30 till 4 on Premier Christian Radio or online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. In the meantime, I hope you have a great start to 2015. Thanks for being with us on Unbelievable during 2014. And coming up next on The Profile, Charmaine Noble-McLean speaks to Anne Graham-Lotz.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.